Throughout the Bible, there are places mentioned. And some of these places are set forth as an example or a monument, if you will, a monument of some memorable event that took place there. At times, God would have His people to set up stones to remind them of some key event so that generations could look at those stones and say, what do those stones mean? And then the parents or the grandparents can say, well, this is what happened here, and I want you to remember that. At other times, God Himself would do something at a place, and the event was of such nature as to leave its mark permanently etched in the memory of generations to come, so that people would wonder and say, what happened here? And what caused the anger of God? Well, Sodom and Gomorrah are such a place, or places, in which God left His mark, His signature, in this place. So I want you to read with me why God had this story inserted, and what was the reason for God's wrath. I'm looking at Genesis chapter 13. The first point I want you to make note of is that early on, when Lot lifted up his eyes and he was deciding where he wanted to take his herds and his belongings, and Abraham says, you choose, it says in Genesis 13, verse 10, that Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before, this was before, he makes note, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. He says it was like the garden of the Lord. It was plush. It was green. It was the opposite of what you see now. And so Moses says this was the way it was before the Lord destroyed this place. It was like the garden of the Lord. It was like the land of Egypt. And he mentions a particular place as you go towards Zoar. So it was a very well-watered plain. And it says, verse 11, that Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. And Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. The point I want us to make note of here is that this was a place much different than it is now. It changed because God poured out His wrath at this place. And chapter 14 tells us that there were civilizations there, that there were kings in place, and so there were probably huge buildings, fortresses for kings to dwell, very rich. Other kings came in and tried to plunder the city because it was a wealthy city. And so as we look at this, we're looking at something much different than you see today. And the reason is because God wanted us to look at this place and remind ourselves that God has demonstrated His wrath against such places, and lessons are to be learned from that. Now, how do you know? How do we know that this was once a lush and civilized place that now you can't even see hardly anything that represents civilization having been there? How do we know that Sodom and Gomorrah was a place of God's wrath? And so I'd like to look at just quickly some brief evidences that demonstrate that it was once a very fertile place. Present is much different than it was in the past. Here I have a quotation demonstrating that as you look at some of the remains that are left behind in certain cases or places right around the Dead Sea, it says a glimpse is also afforded of the Jordan Valley, which is seen in tropical abundance in this quote from Genesis 13, well watered everywhere like the garden of the Lord. It says there's a glimpse that it was a very well tropical place. And he says, archaeological investigations have not only made it reasonably certain that at that time many more lateral streams, that is, streams flowing into the area, lateral streams flowed in the Jordan than there are today. Lots of lateral streams flowing into the Jordan than are there today, but also that it was intensively developed. In spite of its present summer heat and mosquito breeding swamps, it was much different, he says, and archaeology can see remnants or traces of evidence that demonstrate that that was the case. There was a novel written called The Novel of Sinue, dated from the 12th century B.C., and it describes the whole area of Palestine, Syria area, as a land of figs and vines and having wine more abundant than water itself. He says it was plentiful with its honey, abundant, its oil and all fruits on its trees. There was barley, wheat, countless cattle of all kinds. Kind of reminds us of the phrase, a land flowing with milk and honey. And so you find quotations like that. And in 1926, William Albright made this statement as he surveyed the area of the Dead Sea itself. He says, many square miles of former tamarisk groves are now clearly visible under the seawater south of El Lisan, which is a part of the Dead Sea Basin itself. He says it's just evident that a lot of this, these tamarisk groves have now been taken down or carried into that part of the sea, indicating that it once was nothing like what you see now. As you look at it now, it's just very barren. And you could never guess by looking at it now that it would have been an oasis of thriving life, and that Lot would have looked at it and said, if you're going to give me a choice, I'm going to take this place. You wouldn't look at it now and come up with any reasonable degree of sanity on the part of Lot to move him to want that place. Today, you can look at the land, the whole entire region of Palestine, and you can look at it from an aerial view, satellite views, various ways you can look at the land, and there are sections that have been farmed and well kept. And then there are lots of surrounding regions that are just barren and hot. And you wonder, how could the Bible describe the land of Canaan as a land flowing with milk and honey? This quote says, today most of the olive plantations are found in Samaria and in the Galilee. We know from the remains of the olive presses. In other words, you look around the country and you find these olive presses. Here's one represented here. And here is a drawing of many of the remains of houses that are scattered throughout the land of Canaan. And inside these houses, they have lots of clay jars, and they have an olive press in many of these clay houses, indicating that if you can find olive presses, even in desert lands, that there was something different about that land at one time. You wouldn't look at it and say, well, why would anybody build an olive press in this desert land? Well, the reason is because that land was different at one time. And therefore, you would have to take a look back in time and figure, well, if they needed a press this big, it must have been far different than it is now. Scattered around the countryside, you'd find these towers, which are called watchtowers, where they would build it up high enough so that they could tell if somebody was sneaking in their area of where they'd planted their vineyards, and tell if somebody was stealing. And so they built these things all around. And that would tell us then that there was a reason to build it. There were things in that area that indicated that there was once a different landscape full of lush greenery and vines galore. And then there were sufficient reason to be able to press lots of grapes into these wine presses. And it was so abundant in places that they would press them and they would fill these huge vats with them, and they would flow and trickle down into other vats to store it, because they had lots and lots of grapes to press and lots of vats to contain all of that. And you find statements like the Mishnic and the Talmudic literature. They are filled with detailed references to wine harvest, production, consumption, and archaeologists are constantly unearthing remains of ancient wine presses and digs around the country. You look at it now and you say, I can't imagine that this was a land flowing with milk and honey. But the evidence is in the remains. There would have been no reason for these pools unless they had lots and lots of fertility and lots of vines and olive groves and so forth to press these things and to create this kind of need for vats and so forth. So, therefore, we have to consider then that something has happened to the land that has made it much different. Let's look at Genesis 18 for a moment and see what the record says about the land of Sodom and Gomorrah. Chapter 18, just quickly notice verse 20. It says, the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done all together according to the outcry against it that has come up to me, and if not, I will know. I want to know, is it as bad as the cry of it comes up to me? And so it was. Chapter 19, God had decided to destroy it, and Abraham was so concerned about his nephew Lot that he was wondering, well, God, if we find 50 people that are righteous, will you still destroy it? And God said, well, no, if you come up short of that, you come up with 40, and he reduced it on down to 10, and he said in chapter 18, verse 32, Abraham said, suppose 10 should be found there. And God said, well, I won't destroy it for the sake of 10. But God was saying, you're not going to find that, Abraham. So then the angels, two angels, chapter 19, were sent. And they came, it says, verse 1, that Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom. Lot saw them. He rose to meet them. He bowed himself with his face toward the ground. He entertained them, brought them into his own home. Some of the people of the city had noticed these strangers had come into Lot's house. And I want you to notice verse 4. It says, before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house, and they called to Lot and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them carnally. Now, that's a polite way of saying we want to have sexual relationships with them. You know that from the use of that word throughout. It says when Adam knew his wife Eve, well, he knew her in just knowledge-wise, but this is a way of saying that he knew her intimately. And so these men wanted to know these men intimately. That is, they wanted to have sexual intimacy with them, know them in a carnal way. And it says, so Lot went out to through the doorway, shut the door behind him. He says, please, my brethren, do not do so wickedly. What, just get acquainted with the men? No, we're talking about having intimate, carnal relationships with them. That is a wicked thing that you want to do, and Lot says, don't do that. Some have wondered, well, why did Lot offer his daughters in the stead? Perhaps just to bring the degree of shame upon these people who wanted to do something so carnal, to let them see just how perverse they had become in their own thinking and to embarrass them with the fact that they would choose the unnatural over the natural. And it's not that Lot is doing right, and I'm not sure that if he would have actually done that, but probably it is possible, in fact, that he was making a point with the Sodomite people, that your perversity has gone to extreme so that you would not even do something that would be quite natural, and you choose instead that which is perverse and unnatural. Now, in chapter 19, verse 12, notice, The men said to Lot, "Have you anyone else here?" This is the two men that came, the two angels said, "Have you got anybody else here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, whomever you have in the city, take them out of this place, for we'll destroy this place, because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who had married his daughters, and said, "Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. He said, "You don't know what you're talking about. You're kidding, aren't you? This place is going to be destroyed." So they didn't take him seriously. Dropping on down to verse 23, they got out of the city, Lot, his two daughters, his wife. It says, "The sun had risen upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar. And then the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. So he overthrew those cities, all the plain." Notice that it is in a plain, all of that plain, all of the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. Everything that grew in that area was totally wiped out. The reason why God wanted that record was for us to remember, why is this area the way it is? Why was a civilized place so drastically changed? And the answer is because this city was full of the worst kind of perversity that you could imagine. And it says, verse 26, "His wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain, and he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land which went up like the smoke of a furnace. And it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had dwelt." The devastation was a monument to be remembered for generation, from generation to generation. And even to this day, it is supposed to be standing as a monument and a reminder of the wrath of God against all ungodliness. By the time of the first century, Josephus is a historian of the Jews, and he writes regarding this place this. He says, "This country is then so sadly burnt up that nobody cares to come at it. It was of old a most happy land, both for the fruits it bore and the riches of its cities, although it now be all burnt up. It is related how, for the impiety of its inhabitants, it was burnt by lightning, in consequence of which there are still the remainders," and get this point, in the first century, he says, "there are still the remainders of that divine fire." In other words, you can still see the traces of that divine fire that came upon that city, and the traces or shadows of the five cities are still to be seen as of the first century. He says that it's still to be seen. Now, I was thinking that's interesting that as of the first century, traces of the city, the five cities of that plain, were still visible to Josephus and others, and they acknowledged that this was a real event. By 1928, Melvin Grove Kyle says, "The Bible says that there was brimstone." He says, now, brimstone is brimstone. Even though used in a miracle, even if a miracle is involved, brimstone ought to be found, is what he's saying. And he says, "A region on which brimstone was rained will show brimstone." It doesn't matter if it was done by a miracle or by some natural event. He says, brimstone is brimstone, and if that's what happened, you ought to see some brimstone in that area. Well, he says, well, it does. It does show brimstone in that area. "We picked up pure sulfur in pieces as big as the end of my thumb. It is mixed with the marl of the mountains on the west side of the sea, and now is to be found scattered along the shore of the sea, even to the east side, some 4 or 5 miles distant from the ledge that contains the stratum. It has somehow scattered far and wide over this plain. And that was in his Explorations of Sodom, page 52. Now, looking at that, even as of 1928, the monument of God's wrath was still there. And, of course, you could see that progression of thought all the way through. If it was a real event, in other words, if it was a real event, we should see steady references to this great monumental event throughout the history. So what I want to do now is just point out where we're talking about. We're talking about the Sea of Galilee. Various areas around the Sea of Galilee are covered with ash and burnout places, and there is an indication then that there was something tragic and terrible that happened in this place. Now, that was in the days of Abraham. Now we're going to trace throughout the history people looking back to that monumental event and seeing it as a real event. Later on, Moses writes the book of Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy 29, verse 23, several hundred years after it occurred, Moses writes about that land and says, "And that the whole land of it is sulfur and salt and a burning." So that by the time of Moses, he says, if you look at that land, what you're going to find is sulfur, salt, and burning. And that is not sown. People don't plant vineyards or anything over there now. It doesn't bear any kinds of fruit. There's no grass around it. It's like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, which Yahweh overthrew in His anger and in His wrath. And He's saying what happened here can happen to the whole land of Israel is what His point is in this text. It can happen to the whole land like it happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, with that in mind, we are now getting a little taste of what happened to the whole land of Israel. And we look at it as it relates to one of the worst events known at the time, and that was the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain. In chapter 32, he says, "Their vine is the vine of Sodom, the fields of Gomorrah, their grapes are grapes of gall, and their clusters are bitter." Then we fast forward and still people are talking about Sodom and Gomorrah. We come to the book of Isaiah during the period of the divided kingdom period. And Isaiah says to the Israelites, now unless Yahweh of the armies, or the Lord of hosts, some versions would say, unless the Lord of hosts had left us a very small remnant, we would have been as Sodom and we would have been like Gomorrah. In other words, what happened there can happen here. And unless God had provided a small remnant, that's what would have happened to us. And so Isaiah says we need to think about what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah because it can happen to us as well. And then in Isaiah he says, look at their faces, testify again. They parade their sin like Sodom. They're not ashamed of what they're doing. What did the Sodomites do? Well, they paraded their sin. They walked right up to Lot's house, said, bring those men out to us. We want to know them. And he says, the Israelites, they're acting the same way. They don't hide it. They're not ashamed. In the words of Jeremiah, were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? And he says, no, they were not at all ashamed. They were parading it. And we're looking at our own country and we're seeing people parade their sins before our children and before before us in the media in various ways, and they're not ashamed of that. Isaiah 13, verse 19 says, Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be like when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Interestingly, Babylon was like Sodom and Gomorrah. It was once the pride of the Chaldeans, known for its beauty, known for its hanging gardens. It was the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride. Now you look at it, the dust bowl. It doesn't look like much there. It says when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, and he says that's what's going to happen. So he's referencing back the worst thing that they could think about, and this always goes back to Sodom and Gomorrah. Jeremiah chapter 23 says, "The prophets of Jerusalem, also I've seen a horrible thing. They commit adultery, they walk in lies, they strengthen the hands of evildoers, so that none does return from his wickedness. They are all of them become to me as Sodom and its inhabitants as Gomorrah. And as in the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the neighbor cities of it, says Yahweh, no man shall dwell there, neither shall any son of man sojourn there." Speaking of Babylon. Jeremiah 50:30 says, "As when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah and the neighbor cities, no man will dwell there, neither shall any son of man sojourn there." Speaking of Jerusalem, rather, I said Babylon. Jerusalem now is going to be destroyed. In Lamentations, it was destroyed. In Jeremiah's lamenting, he says, "For the iniquity of the daughter of my people is greater than the sin of Sodom, that was overthrown as in a moment, and no hands were laid on her." In other words, everything that happened since Sodom and Gomorrah, every other destruction is compared to it. Amos chapter 4, "I have overthrown some of you," talking about the children of Israel, "as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, and you were like a burning stick plucked out of the fire." Zephaniah chapter 2 speaks of, again, "Surely Moab will be as Sodom and the children of Ammon as Gomorrah, possession of nettles and salt pits, and a perpetual desolation." Perpetual desolation. He speaks of Moab and says that's the way Sodom and Gomorrah was, and that's the way Moab's going to be. "The remnant of our people will plunder them. The survivors of thy nation will inherit them." Now we fast forward and we come even up to the time of Christ, and people are still talking about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, so that Jesus says, "I'll tell you, it'll be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city that heard Jesus himself, the Son of God, and still rejected him." He says, we're going to be more tolerant of the people of Sodom and Gomorrah in that day than we are of those who rejected the Son of God. What is worse, homosexuality or rejecting Jesus, the Son of God? Well, obviously, it's rejecting Jesus, the Son of God, who can save us from any kind of sin. And so it is worse to reject the evidence of Jesus, the Son of God. Now we notice he goes on further in Matthew chapter 11. Says, "You, Capernaum, you really had a great opportunity." Why? Because the Son of God was there in your city and he made it his home base. You had the greatest opportunity in the world, Capernaum. You have been exalted to heaven. You're going to go down to Hades. "For if the mighty works that had been done in Sodom," or "which had been done in Sodom, if the mighty works had been done in Sodom which were done in you, it would have remained until this day." Why, people would there at Sodom just might have changed if they had your opportunity. He says, "But I tell you, it'll be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you." In Mark chapter 6, "Whoever will not receive you nor hear you," Jesus says to his disciples, "as you depart from there, shake off the dust that's under your feet as a testimony against them. Assuredly, I say to you, it'll be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city." In other words, our opportunities are so much greater than the peoples of Sodom and Gomorrah, and therefore our responsibility is greater than theirs. And in Luke chapter 10, verse 12, he says, "I tell you, it'll be more tolerable in that day for Sodom than it is for that city." And again, later on, he compares the judgment in this way. He says, "In that day, Lot went out from Sodom, and it rained fire and sulfur from the sky and destroyed them all." Jesus tells the story the same way it was told in the book of Genesis, and thereby showing us that it was so. Later on, Paul writes his book of Romans and quotes Isaiah again on the factuality of places becoming like Sodom and Gomorrah. And then Peter makes this interesting statement about it. In 2 Peter 2:6, says, turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes. Make note that Sodom and Gomorrah were still standing in ashes. That is, they were monuments and reminders of the wrath of God, even up to the days of the first century, when Peter would say, God turned them to ashes, condemned them to destruction. He made them an example. That's what we're saying a monument is. A monument stands there to remind us of something. And Sodom and Gomorrah were made an example to those who would live ungodly and say, look, God hasn't changed His mind about homosexuality. He hasn't changed His mind about adultery. He hasn't changed His mind about drunkenness. His wrath is going to be poured out on the ungodly, whatever there is, whatever kind of ungodliness they choose to protect and practice. They ought to take a look at Sodom and Gomorrah. The book of Jude says this, even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, having in the same way as these given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh. Strange flesh being, it's not male with female flesh, it is male with male, and that is strange flesh. And he says they are set forth as an example. God did this to place a monument into the world that would never be forgotten. And he says they're suffering the punishment of eternal fire. They're set forth as an example, suffering the punishment of eternal fire. Revelation 8 closes the last book of the Bible. Says they're talking about Jerusalem, said their dead bodies will be in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. Meaning that the crime of unbelief brought about the wrath of God on Jerusalem as well. Now, let's make some notes and observations about what you find there even to this day. Archaeologists point to areas around the place where you can find actual burnt out layers or burnt layers testifying that there was a fiery destruction that overcame the city. And then on top of those layers you go up and all you find is layer upon layer of ash, meaning that the ash and the smoke went up. Abraham saw it for miles away. It's kind of like Mount St. Helens. You'd look at the ash going for miles and miles in the distance, and then it would begin to fall little by little and settle in layers on top of the city. And so what you find in that area now are visible remains of that destruction that has been referred to all the way throughout the Bible. You'll find also ash and sulfur in many of the surrounding areas, just all around the Dead Sea area, indicating that there were streets here. You find rocks that line certain streets or indicate certain foundations of huge buildings at one time, indicating something drastically changed this whole area. It was livable at one time. Now you look at it, and there's nothing attractive about it. The only thing that attracts people is that the sea, the Dead Sea, is so full of sulfur and salt that people find that that is very good for arthritis. And so they'll go and they'll get into the Dead Sea and float around in it and try and put mud packs on them themselves. But that's the only benefit that people find in this area, is that they might find a little relief from their pain. And so they'll go there for that reason, also for sightseeing and also for amazement to see that such a place once was livable and now is not livable at all. There are traces still. In the first century, you could find brimstone. In 1928, you could find brimstone in abundance. People have picked up a lot of that and carried it as souvenirs all over the world. But you can still find brimstone in all over the place around the Dead Sea and the cities of the plain. You might even look at some of these things and see these are natural land formations. might be natural land formations, but they may be the remains of ziggurats and temples that have just been turned to ashes. Some of this looks like it might be the remains of building structures like a ziggurat or some kind of temple. And yet now all you find all around in the area are ash layers. Here you find layer upon layer upon layer of ashes, layers of ash all around in that area. Now there are different theories as to where Sodom and Gomorrah are located. Some would locate it in this basin here. There was a little land bridge now that you can find at certain times of the year when the sea will fill up and then trickle on down into this other basin. Other times it's just this is covered up. But some think that Sodom and Gomorrah are covered in this watered area. Could be. Others look at the area and say, no, it looks like it could have been here on the outlying skirts of the Dead Sea area. But nevertheless, all in this area, from one end and all the way up to another area of the sea basin, you find ash and burnout areas. There are salt stacks that some people refer to as Lot's wife. Various reminders that what happened to Lot's wife is that she was turned to, I'm not saying that that's Lot's wife, I'm just saying that there are reminders, because there are standing pillars of salt in the area, that there are reminders of what happened to Lot's wife. And as you look at the salt sea, you see build up on the shores of lots and lots of salt. Nearby areas, for example, like Numera, did not get as fully disintegrated as Sodom and Gomorrah. And so there are greater traces of those cities around in the plain like Numera, where you can go down into some basement areas and you can still find, or at least at one time, before it was ransacked, you could find on tables, now covered, later covered with ash, you could find even bowls that were full of grapes. And so archaeologists make reference to that. Now, having said all of that, and having looked at that area, I want us to see what lessons we learn from that. I want you to turn to the book of Romans, Romans chapter 1, and I want you to read with me starting with verse 18. Romans 1, verse 18. Paul says, the reason the world needs the powerful gospel is because the only way to make people righteous is revealed in the gospel. Otherwise, chapter 1, verse 18 says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. In what way has the wrath of God been revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men? Well, obviously, one of the ways is that God left monuments of His wrath against all ungodliness so that people could say, well, you'd think God's going to put up with this? Look what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. You think God is going to tolerate this? You think God is going to be happy with this? And so Paul says, look, the wrath of God has been revealed. That is, He didn't spare and hold back anything about this. You know God has poured out His wrath against all ungodliness. Now, how did He do that? Well, He rained it from heaven on occasions like at Sodom and Gomorrah. It has been revealed from heaven. God revealed it from heaven. Now, some of it is physically revealing it in the fire and brimstone that He brought upon the place. Other ways is that He revealed it in His written word that tells us about it throughout history. God left His monuments of wrath against all ungodliness. So let's not think that we can escape the wrath of God without the gospel of Christ. We've got to have the gospel of Christ, because otherwise we're left exposed to the wrath of God. His wrath is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness. The second thing I want you to make note of in this chapter is that he says those who practice such things. Now he lists things, such things as this. Look in verse 29. He says, being filled with all unrighteousness. Examples of all unrighteousness are things like sexual immorality, wickedness, even covetousness, even maliciousness, even being full of envy and murder, strife and deceit, being full of evil-mindedness, even talking behind somebody's back, being a whisperer, or backbiting somebody, being a hater of God and being violent or proud, or being a boaster or inventor of evil things, or, listen to this, even being disobedient to parents. Wow, listen to that. Being disobedient to parents deserves what? Well, they took them out and stoned them to death in the Old Testament. And God says it hasn't changed, and we may change the manner of approach, but it's still worthy of death. And he says this, people are undiscerning, they're unwilling to think, unwilling to discern, to choose between right and wrong and make sure that they know what right and wrong is. They just don't want to admit that there is such a thing as right and wrong, and so they're undiscerning people. He says people are going to be that way. They deserve to die. He says they're untrustworthy. Just being an untrustworthy person, you deserve to die. Being unloving, you're put here to be a loving person. But being unloving, he says, you deserve to die. You're put here to be a forgiving person, but if you're not going to forgive, you deserve to die. You're here to display mercy and be merciful, but if you're not going to be merciful, you deserve to die. And he says, who knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things, all of those things that he just mentioned, those who practice such things are worthy of death. But he says they not only do those things, but we pat each other on the back and practice the same things and encourage that along in other people. He says, now when that happens, you deserve to die. You deserve what Sodom and Gomorrah got. And so those who practice such things deserve death. That's why we need the gospel. Is because somehow we've got to realize we have sinned in such a way that we deserve to die and we don't want this kind of death. The gospel is the only way out. It's the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. The third thing that I want us to know from this is that there are steps toward depravity. You don't all of a sudden become instantaneously a depraved person, as is described here. There are steps toward depravity. And here he describes them, starting with verse 21. He says, although they knew God, they knew He was there. They even knew His wrath that had been revealed from heaven. He said, but although they knew God, they didn't glorify Him as God. God deserves so much better glory and praise and adoration than we gave Him. And he says, they weren't even thankful. God gave you your life. God gave you your breath, the food on your table, the seasons. He's given you all of that, and you ignore Him and not even thankful to Him, then you deserve to die. He says they became futile in their thoughts. Notice the progression. You don't think about God. You don't glorify Him as God. You're not even thankful to Him. And so your thinking becomes all messed up. Became futile in their thoughts. Their foolish hearts were darkened. They thought they were smart. They became fools. They changed the glory of God into image made like corruptible men. God gave them up to uncleanness. There are steps toward the depravity that He speaks of. And He says they changed the truth for the lie. They worshiped the creature. He says God gave them up to vile passions. The progression now gets to the vile stage. And that was the stage that Sodom and Gomorrah were in. It says even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. And men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another. Men with men committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which was due. In other words, Sodom and Gomorrah got what they were due. Now, if that's the case, then we need to learn this. Vile passions develop within us in slow stages to the point that we neglect our Creator, forget about Him, and then we're given over to vile passions. Sodom and Gomorrah got the just penalty of their era. And I think we learned this, that monument stands to continue to remind us not to allow our passions to pull us so far away from God that He's not in any of our thoughts. If you're here tonight and you've never obeyed the gospel, I hope the study of Sodom and Gomorrah will remind you, God is still against all ungodliness. Even if you haven't gone to that part, maybe you haven't gone to that degree, you're still worthy of death if you're not glorifying God as God. And if we can help you in your obedience to Him tonight, please come and let your wishes be made known as we stand together and sing.